Hello, and welcome to Academy Conversations Uncut, a podcast of rare Q&As with the world's foremost filmmakers, hosted by the Academy and released for the first time to the public, unedited. Today's panel was recorded in December 2017 at the Samuel Goldwyn Theater in Beverly Hills, California, discussing the movie Downsizing, a satirical science fiction comedy about a couple who decide to shrink themselves to 5 inches tall in order to live a better life. We were joined by writer, director, producer Alexander Payne, producer and writer Jim Taylor, producer Mark Johnson, and actor Hong Chow. The panel was hosted by John Horn. Here's John.
Good afternoon. My name's John Horn. I'm the host of The Frame on KPCC. Yay, public radio fans. I'm going to start by saying Matt Damon had a family emergency and is unable to join us, so I apologize on his behalf. I'd like to bring up our panel, writer-director Alexander Payne. Producer and writer Jim Taylor. Producer Mark Johnson. And actor Hong Chow. Hello, everybody.
And good evening.
Alexander and Jim, I remember talking with you about this movie about 10 years ago. I think that was maybe when you had the first idea or conversation. Do I have the timing about right?
Yeah, I don't remember the conversation exactly.
No, the timing
about 10 years past. We had wanted this to be our first film after Sideways.
And it wasn't, but nope. Tell me about the evolution, about what that time meant and what the process of writing demanded in terms of time.
Yeah, we had no idea that this would take so darn long to get made, and it took so long really for two reasons. One, the screenplay was hard to, because it's such a big idea and you can take it in so many directions. We had the premise, it's a good movie premise, it's silly and serious and cinematic and allows for a lot of, allows us to throw our net of, let's say, social satire around a lot of things. How do you find the right story and character to serve as a vehicle to guide us through a world in which downsizing could actually happen? So that took longer than we thought. And then it was nearly impossible to find funding. We first tried in 2009, unsuccessfully, realizing it wasn't the right time. I went and made two other features and we did other stuff. And then after Nebraska, circled back around to it. And even then it coalesced and fell apart a couple times before finally coming together.
When you think back to the original idea that you had, the original spark of the story, did the movie end up reflecting that spark pretty authentically, even if it took different paths as you were writing it?
Yeah, for sure.
And what was that spark? What was that initial idea?
There was one spark, which is my brother was thinking about making people tiny and talking to me about it. And he wasn't thinking about a movie, he just was...
What ifing?
Yeah, making some calculations. And then I thought, that could make an interesting movie. And really, the most important thing for all of us, I think, as we were making this movie that has a lot of visual effects in it and is sort of on a different scale than other movies made, is we wanted to make sure that it still felt like a movie about people and a movie that Alexander made. And I remember watching the first cut without the visual effects and everything and saying, looks like an Alexander Payne movie, and that made me happy.
You are famous for the way in which you cast your films, no part is too small, that you are going to look at every person who's up for every role, and you're often going to populate your films with non-professional actors. So we'll get to Hong in a second, but in terms of the overall casting of this film, what were the things that you were looking for from the get-go, and how the cast end up coming together?
Nothing different. You had me at You Are Famous, so thank you for that. the process, look, I just came from an interview. We've been doing our press junket a few blocks away at the Four Seasons today. And someone said, you know, was this a harder film and a really different film and why? And I said, well, it was just like any other film I've ever made, except more of it. obviously, visual effects was new for me, but, you know, that was fun and interesting. But casting, the answer is the same. It was the same process my fine casting director, John Jackson, and I have always used, just more of it. Mm-hmm. And stretching across four different shooting locations. We shot in Omaha, Los Angeles, Norway, and Toronto. A lot of it, most of it was shot in Toronto.
And where did you find...
But it's true, just real quick, yep. It's true that we spend as much, if not sometimes more time on finding the right person, to a day player to do one line. It's in a way, the stars are the easiest part. It's the day players who take a lot of time.
Meaning a bad day player will take you out of a movie and a good day player can make the movie?
Yeah, you want everyone to contribute solidly to the reality that you're trying to portray. I still kick myself over one bad day player in About Schmidt.
I won't ask you what scene, but we'll go back and look at it and find it. And where did you find Hong Chau?
She came in on an audition. We began casting and were looking, beginning to make contacts in Vietnam and Australia and Canada and Paris and anywhere where there's a sizable Vietnamese community. And she came in and read for John, the casting director, about 2 or 3 weeks into casting. And thank God she saved us a lot of trouble. And she was right here under our nose, living 3 miles away from our casting office.
To a global casting church. And
she was right there under our nose. But thank God we found her early.
Hong, do you remember that first meeting about this film and why this part was important to you?
I do. Well, when I went in and read for John, he told me that was very lovely what you did. And, you know, just sit tight because you're not going to hear anything for 2 months. And I heard 2 days later that Alexander had seen my audition tape. So that was an incredibly exciting phone call to get. And then to get to meet this man that I had admired for a very long time. I've seen all of Alexander's films. And I was a little bit of a goober. I didn't think that I made a really strong impression on him. I thought, well, he thinks I'm a good egg, but I don't know. I might have talked myself out of the role, honestly.
No, just not to bore you with the anecdote you might not be interested in, but I liked her audition tape so much that I told John, please arrange for me to have a coffee with her. Because when she came back for the callback, I wanted to have her succeed, so I could get to know her a little bit and then could give her some direction.
And it worked.
Yes and no. Because Alexander is so thorough in his casting search, he still, even though he liked what I did, he still looked at some more people, and I'm glad that he did. It's a nice feeling to go into a job feeling like the director has a lot of confidence in you, and you're the person, the only person who can play that role. So I really, even though it was a heart racing waiting period for me, I'm glad that it turned out the way that it did.
Mark, Alexander has a team with whom he works very closely. Jim is a member of that. Music, Rolf Kent, costumes, Wendy Chuck, editor, Kevin Tent. Faden Papa Michael, cinematographer. It's a group, a core group. Yep. You're the interloper, right? How did you work your way into the circle?
Well, you said when I talked to you about it earlier, you said a lot of guys must have turned the job down. No, are you kidding?
You didn't have to say that.
The opportunity to produce an Alexander Payne movie is just too delicious. And so Alexander called me up and asked me if I wanted to do it. And I probably took all of 7 seconds before I said yes. But we had been working on something. We've known each other for a long time, never really done a film together. And we had been working on something, a film that we still hope to do at some point in Spanish, since we both speak Spanish, and it's based on a short story we both like a lot. And it was just going along well, and I think the timing was perfect. So Alexander asked me if I'd come in. This was about 3 years ago, so I really am a newcomer.
I want to ask you about how you work with actors and the way you shoot actors. You have an intimacy about being close to your camera and about working very closely with Faden, that you are not behind a bank of monitors. You're up close. You're seeing your actors as they're in front of the camera. How much of that are you able to preserve when you're dealing with an effects film where there are a lot of different things going on? You probably have bigger sets. You have more extras. How do you maintain the intimacy with your actors and with your camera department on a much bigger movie like this?
While you're asking that question, I was flashing back to making my Project One in Super 8 at UCLA, where it was myself, the actor, and a Super 8 camera in Griffith Park. And I I thought I recognized a friend.
You thought that actor was here.
No, it's just somehow throughout the machinery of any level of filmmaking, that's the most important thing. It's like I could show up on set and be surrounded by this huge set and 1,000 extras and all that sort of thing, and I still think about making my Project One in Super 8 at UCLA and having that intimate connection between myself and the actor. There's a lot of the machinery of American filmmaking which can, if you let it, mar that relationship between director and actor, but it's the job of the director, I feel, is to really keep that tight. And I think it means something to the actors that the director is right there with them. I could never imagine being behind a monitor.
Can I ask about the day you shot the scene where your character says that she wants to go to Norway? Can you talk a little bit about that day and about what that meant to you as an actor and what that meant to you to director?
Well, oddly, it's those big scenes that I actually don't really try to overthink. Of course, I know that it's important in the movie, but hopefully if I've done all of my homework, right, it's not this thing that I really have to muscle. And everything that I prepared for all of the other scenes and all of the character work is going to give me that momentum to do a big scene like that. And that was actually our first take
take one.
That's unbelievable. That in the film is the first take.
I could never do that with, you know, to deliver an intimate performance and cry with those lights and the unblinking cyclops of the camera creeping steadily close and having that concentration and focus. How the hell do you, anyway. A neat thing about being director is watching these people do that, mm-hmm. watching these great actors do that stuff. It's pretty unbelievable.
When you were thinking about the production design, about what this leisure land is going to look like, I was thinking about Celebration, the Disney city in Florida. I was thinking of the Queen of Versailles, the documentary about those houses. Mm-hmm. Was there a reference that you all talked about what this made-up world would look like, and where did you end up either creating it or filming it?
Yeah, it's sort of a combo pack among Orlando, Palm Springs, and Las Vegas. I didn't want it to have that kind of precious precision that you maybe saw in Edward Scissorhands or The Truman Show. It still should feel real and lived in and so forth. And a lot of it is designed. I mean, when they're in the viewing corridor early on and looking through the big windows, that's all digital, but based on months and months of design by urban planners we hired, mm-hmm. like really what would this be? And then in terms of the houses, there we found locations. You think Canadians are all thrifty and modest and stuff. They ain't. It's all a big front. They have some of the most hideous, opulent mansions and McMansions you've ever seen in your life up there.
This is near Toronto, Ontario?
Outside of Toronto, yeah. So the house where they deliver Matt Damon, his big castle, is a location in Toronto. They all were.
I want to ask you about this idea of this city being walled off and then the people who work in it, who support it, being walled off. Certainly that's a topical idea. How early in the story was there a wall or the separation between the haves and have-nots?
Well, that is a case of the world catching up with us.
Sadly.
Yes, we had written that in fairly early on before there was any, before a wall was even a twinkle in our president's eye. But, you know, I would say the funny, this is kind of off topic, but I was, it's so hard to comprehend people accepting this absurd idea of building this wall around our country. But I guess so many communities now are built as walled communities that it's become a more an idea that's easier to comprehend.
I want to come back to casting about getting Matt on and what Matt meant to the film in terms of getting it made. Did that help? And
oh, God, yes.
I hope so.
He's a big bankable movie star. Okay. Thank God he exists. Had he not existed, I don't know whom I would have cast. No, seriously. And I needed a wonderful actor who I also believe can play an everyman in his mid-40s. And who could also help me get a hefty budget. And there's really only Matt Damon. Mr. Hanks could have done it, but he's a little older, half a generation older, and so not quite right. Could have played it 10 years ago.
Probably wouldn't shave his head either.
Well, that was movie magic.
Oh, my goodness. Didn't see my barber then.
But Damon is the guy. Damon's the guy.
When you are cutting a film, I know that's a really good part of the process for you, that you really enjoy editorial. What were the challenges editorially with this film, and were they unique to the story that other films wouldn't have presented?
It's a weird movie. You guys just saw it, and thanks for showing up to see it tonight, but it's a strange movie. It's a crazy movie that takes hairpin turns and U-turns, and it throws off some viewers, and other people think that's what makes it delightful. It's the most episodic structure of a film of any film Jim and I have done. And corralling that and making it really coalesce into a single film was took a little bit of time,
What about tone? Where did you find yourself going back and forth in terms of tone? What were the conversations? Did it always kind of follow the same path?
We never have conversations of tone.
But you know when something's right or something's wrong.
Yeah, of course. But it's you feel it and you see it. I don't mean to take your question too literally or not answer it or something, but it's just very instinctive between Jim and me as writers and then Kevin and me in the editing room about what feels right, what's funny, what's dramatic, what's surprising. You know, is there a better way I could answer?
No, it's hard. I mean, I think you know it when you see it, but I think you can also say to yourself, this feels too funny, this feels too broad, this feels too on the nose. Maybe it's things that you don't want to do. Maybe you back off from things that you think.
Am I blanking? Did we have anything in cutting where we?
Well, what did you lose?
You're always doing that. We're walking. No, we're all. I mean, we might not be talking about it in the same way, but we're, especially I think editorially, you have to know when you can, maybe you're so used to doing it because it's so much a part of the movies is the fine balance and being able to make those shifts, which is unusual and it's tricky. And maybe you just do it so much.
Mark, you were watching this for the first time. How would you explain his process? Because it's really hard for you to have perspective on your own work.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. I'm just going to bring up something, and I don't know if it's a tonal thing or not. Towards the end, when we're introduced to little Ronnie again, and he has a herpes sore.
That's a good example.
And we have a couple of angles on it. And I, as the obnoxious, not quite getting it producer, wanted to make sure we had it covered well. So we have a closer shot than we at one point.
Oh, I like the close up. STD jokes.
Right.
People love that stuff. They eat it up.
But and it clearly doesn't work because it as it is now, some people get it and remember what Christoph said about little Ronnie's sexual life or whatever, and others don't. But I think it's part watching Alexander and Kevin Tent, who's his longtime editor, sort of experiment with things. And, you know, as much as Alexander and Jim knew what they were writing, as much as Alexander knew when he was directing it, you still you still find the movie. Yes, of course you have the material, and it's a long process. It's a real dialogue, even the dialectic between these two, and that's where the movie, and I think often the tone, while of course it's in the right neighborhood, but really gets zeroed in.
Hong, what did you base your accent on? Where did that come from?
I had a lot of different sources of inspiration just because the character was so complex and multi-layered. She's not just an Asian Vietnamese woman. She's also an environmental activist. She's also a refugee. She's got a whole, she's also a woman of faith. And I, as a person who grew up in Louisiana around a lot of people who are, have a lot of faith, that was a nice, for me to get to play a character that embodied that. We don't often see all of these characteristics in one person, and we are like that in real life, but for some reason it doesn't get translated onto the screen, and I think that's mostly because people don't really know how to do it, and these Jim and Alexander did something that is so difficult and they made it look so easy. But back to your question, the accent. I drew from my own family. My parents are Vietnamese refugees. They left Vietnam after the war and ended up in a refugee camp in Thailand, and that's where I was born. I grew up in New Orleans, Louisiana, in a community that is mostly Vietnamese immigrants and refugees, so I do have an ear for that accent. But at the end of the day, she's mine. You know, she's just a lady who occupies a studio apartment inside my heart.
I've had a number of Vietnamese Americans see the movie and come up to me and say, "Oh, she's got traces of my aunt, or she sounds like my grandmother, or she's and these are she's invented a character that somehow has reverberations onto real people."
I want to ask you about Omaha, Nebraska. It's not just where you come from, but it means it means something to pretty much everything you do. How would you define what it means to this story, what it means to Paul, the character in it?
This movie starts, forget the Norwegians, finding the thing once we find Matt Damon. I just wanted to drop an anchor in something in somewhere recognizable and felt by me, mm-hmm. and that's Omaha. Because the movie then branches out in so many crazy directions, I wanted to root it there in a place that I just said it means something to me. Also, I love shooting there, and I hadn't shot there in years. I had shot Nebraska, but I hadn't shot in Omaha since about Schmidt.
I know better to ask you what this means, but how did you end up writing the end of the film? What were the conversations that you and Jim had? What kind of note did you want to strike? People can interpret it however they want to interpret it, but what was important about what you were going to communicate in that final scene?
We may have different answers. Mine is that, not to compare this...
Wrong. Sorry.
Not to compare this film with those great films, but Knights of Cabiria, La Dolce Vita, 8.5, you follow a character through a series of often seemingly unrelated episodes and meeting a whole new bunch of characters. And then by the end of the picture, there's a close-up on the protagonist's face in which the breadth of the experience maybe has a chance to wash over the protagonist and possibly over the viewer as well. And perhaps a narrative thread which had felt loose is suddenly pulled taut. Mm-hmm. And that's what I was, again, not to compare my film with those, but that's the feeling that I kind of wanted to have with that final close-up on the man's face.
Yeah, and you mentioned it. I mean, you were quite, the story could take a lot of different avenues to get to that place, but that was something that, and I think it's an impulse out of that it's a story that is more international than we've written before, and it's also, it's global, it's, and really coming back to the individual was the most important thing.
I know that this movie, like a lot of your movies, take a long time to make. Will the next movie maybe be a little bit faster? Because
I sure hope so.
Because
no more dream projects for me. It take too damn long.
I want to ask about the very final credit we saw on the screen, a dedication for George. Who is George and what did he mean to this film?
I lost a brother to pancreatic cancer a couple of years ago.
And that is George.
Yeah, he didn't get to see the picture.
Alexander, Jim, Mark, Hong, thank you for bringing us your movie.
Thank you.
And thank you guys for coming out.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for listening to Academy Conversations Uncut. We hope you enjoyed this unique access to a members-only Q&A at the Academy. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe and help us reach film lovers around the world. This podcast was produced by the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences.